Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, historian Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of many respected and beloved books about history, including The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution, and Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. He's out now with a new book, also regarding George Washington. This one, a sort of recreation. The book is called Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy, in which our guest, Nathaniel Philbrick, recreates Washington's journey as a new president through the unsure nation made up of all 13 former colonies. It's a deeply personal book, part memoir, part travelogue, part history. When George Washington became president in 1789, the United States of America was still a loose and quarrelsome confederation and a tentative political experiment. Washington undertook a tour of the ex-colonies to talk to ordinary citizens about his new government and to imbue in them the idea of being one, Americans, an optimistic accord and a hopeful one, which is what we need more of today. I'm thrilled to have him right here with me, Nathaniel Philbrick. Welcome.
It's great to be with you.
Speaking about New England, you have New England roots and your own DNA that go back many, 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 many generations. George Washington and New England, we don't usually put the two together. What the hell was he doing in New England?
Yeah, I know. We think of him as a Virginian, the Potomac, Washington, D.C. But when he was president and became president in 1789, he realized he was a leader of 13 essentially independent states, that he had to do something to create a sense of national unity. And this was before mass media, before, you know, you had the president was virtually omnipresent on your TV screen. If he was going to reach out to the people, he had to go to the people. And so he set out on a series of road trips that would take him. His first would be a tour of New England that would take him all the way to Kittery Point, Maine. And so he would visit more than 60 towns in New England. It would take him more than a month, and staying only in public taverns because he was a man of the people. And so this was Washington's listening tour, but it was also a means by which he could show everyone in all these little towns that there was something larger than their town, their state. There was this new thing called the United States of America, and he was their chief executive.
Step back for a second, if you would. There's probably near 1,000 books on George Washington. You yourself have written before book on George Washington.
Right.
There's thousands of articles and newspaper pieces and vignettes, and who knows how much has been written about George Washington, a lot. Why did you feel that, A, you had something more to add, you had more digging to do? I mean, is this a pool that can be plumbed forever? The pool that is the man, the character, George Washington?
Well, I think Washington is in many ways synonymous with the beginning of this country. You know, without him, there's no doubt that we probably wouldn't have won the Revolutionary War. And without him, you know, we had the Constitution, but we needed someone to be that first executive to create the precedent by which future presidencies would be based. And so Washington, despite his many flaws, is essential. And so, yes, there have been tons of things written about him. But for me, I had just finished my third book about the American Revolution. I was all three of which really were deep dives into the archives. And I needed a change. I wanted to get out of my office surrounded by my books. I wanted to get out and see this country. But I also wanted to know what happened to George Washington next. And so I decided I was going to follow him on his presidential travels. This was a time, obviously, when our political divide feels like it's wider than it's ever been before. And I thought, you know, it'd be an interesting exercise to travel America, following his footsteps around this country as he tried to unite this country in the context of a time of unprecedented division. And so with my wife, Melissa, at my side and our dog, Dora, we set out on a year and a half journey following George Washington. And so the book goes back and forth between our journey and Washington's into those two worlds of the past and the present and seeing what connections exist to this day.
I was thinking about what kind of a book this is. It's part memoir, part travel literature, part history, part contemporary cultural observation meets analyses of the past. That's a lot what you like to do, is sort of connect the present to the past. A big theme of the book, I think, in fact, is your insistence, which I admire, that we look at George Washington with as broad a lens as possible, that he was a flawed individual, as we've come to learn, as many people have known for a long time, and the greater public has come to learn. But through those flaws, he had certain incredibly generous and incredibly, you could say, progressive and worldly character traits that made him be able to be the uniter that he was.
Yeah. And, you know, the complexity of Washington is what fascinated both my wife and I as we followed his travels around the country. You know, you're right. He was a flawed man. He was a slaveholder for his entire life. Yes, he would free his enslaved workers upon his death, but it was after he died. That said, this is a man who became a slave owner at age 11 when his father died, and he inherited some enslaved workers. And so Washington is one of those people who was born into one system, and after experiencing the 8 years of the American Revolution, his worldview began to change. You know, African-American soldiers had served in his army. One of his chief officers was General Lafayette from France, who would later say that if he had known that by winning the American Revolution, he was participating in a war that created a country in which slavery was allowed, he would never have participated in that war. This man was like a son to Washington. And so Washington began to realize that, you know, slavery was not the way to go forward if America was going to be true to the Declaration of Independence, that all people are created equal. And for Washington as president, you know, he was a brilliant man, but he was not a thinker like Jefferson or Hamilton. He had a tendency to sort of focus on the single most important issue at hand, whether it was the Revolution and fighting a defensive war that allowed America to outlast the British. As president, all his attention was on creating a union of states. And so, in the beginning, this meant the toleration of Southern slavery. But this didn't mean that Washington saw slavery as a part of America's future. Thomas Jefferson would note that Washington had been heard saying that if slavery should ever divide this nation, I will go with the northern part, which is a remarkable statement coming from a Virginia slaveholder. And I think that's part of the complexity of Washington, that make me, you know, yes, he was full of flaws, as any human being is, but he was also wedded to an ideal that come the Civil War, would the Union would be the support of the Union would lead Abraham Lincoln to issuing the Emancipation Proclamation. And so I think Washington is, yes, he's been written about in many different ways, but he is a well I think all Americans need to go back to with every generation, as each generation looks back with a different perspective as you know we move into the future.
Let's talk a little more specifically about this trip that he goes on. So paint a picture of America at the time, 1789, and talk about what disparate moods there were, what states mm-hmm. were like. I'm in New Hampshire right now, and when I go across the Connecticut River to Vermont, it's very different. It is a very yeah. different state for people who think they're the same. But back then, it would have been much more so.
Absolutely. We now take the United States of America as a foregone conclusion. It was not, it was anything but that in 1789. And as you know, you notice today, the states can, even though they can be side by side, are very different. And in 1789, the governor of Virginia, when he said my country, he didn't mean the United States. He meant Virginia. Everybody had was focused in that direction. The states had been, before the ratification of the Constitution, the states had been where this majority of the power resided. Governors were the ones that really had the executive sway. But now it was different with the Constitution. And, you know, people can be are deeply conservative by nature, and to this is a radical change. And there were, you know, especially in some portions of the country, particularly in the South, this they looked with great mistrust on the very notion of there being such a powerful federal government. You know, there was already a political division. You know, we're divided today. Well, then it was the Constitution that had divided the American people. Those that were for it were known as Federalists. You know, they were for the strong national government that the Constitution created. And then there were the Anti-Federalists who mistrusted this government and executive leader who had the potential of becoming another king. And they felt the states should retain more of their power. And when Washington became president, two states, Rhode Island and North Carolina, had not even ratified the Constitution yet. They hadn't participated in his election.
And in fact, so, while he was traveling through New England, he skipped Rhode Island for that exact reason, which seems very odd to a 21st century American, that the president wouldn't visit a state because it hadn't ratified the Constitution. Does that also mean they didn't recognize him as president?
Right. Well, they having not ratified the Constitution, you know, they were outside of it. I think it's kind of like the EU, you know, in Europe. You know, England is a part of Europe, but it's not part of the EU. And in Rhode Island and North Carolina's situation, it became clear that, you know, economically, if they were going to function, they really needed to become a part of these United States. But they, you know, it was something they went into very, very reluctantly. To modern day American citizens, this is kind of extraordinary, you know, to think that Washington would tour New England, but he planned the tour that he avoided Rhode Island. And by doing that, he was very well aware that he was applying a lot of pressure on Rhode Island, you know, making it obvious that they were outside this charmed circle. And sure enough, within the year, Rhode Island would become a part of the Constitution. And how did Washington respond? You know, he didn't ice them out and say, you know, since you were the last, by this time, North Carolina had finally come in. Rhode Island was the prodigal son, if you will. Washington decides, I'm going to get on a schooner. New York at this time was the temporary capital. Washington hops on a schooner and sails for Newport and then Providence. And, you know, this was risky. These were the biggest skeptics in America at that time. How would they receive him? Well, they were actually quite surprised that Washington would go to the trouble and greeted him with surprise and gratitude. And by the end of his visits to Newport and Providence, he had turned some of, you know, his biggest potential haters into some of his biggest fans. And you know, this was Washington being very willing to reach across that partisan divide and enter what I think modern political pundits would refer to as enemy territory. He didn't necessarily see it that way. He was trying to create, once again, a union.
And in fact, you're right, quoting here, the country's political divide seemed to be widening by the day. This is at the time you're setting out on your voyage, continuing to quote, "And yet I didn't want this trip to be about what separates us. I wanted to find out how Washington attempted to bind us together into a lasting union of states," acknowledging and even delving into his weaknesses and failings, especially when it came to slavery. "I wanted to know what Washington got right, what tools he and his generation had left us to begin to build a better nation." And then I'm skipping forward a little bit. You have a wonderful quote from Steinbeck here, which is, "We do not take a trip takes us. The certain way to be wrong is to think you control it." And then you continue, "Every day on the road with George proved the truth of this claim. Just when we thought he was leading us on a journey of quirky and lighthearted adventure through the Middle Atlantic and New England states, we arrived in Newport, Rhode Island, the seat of the American slave trade. Today, as I write this, I can't help but wonder whether our country will survive the next unexpected turn of events. More than ever before, Americans need to know what our first president did at the very beginning to bring this nation together." How did he talk to people? How did he talk to people who hated him? How did he talk to people who vehemently disagreed? Obviously, mm-hmm. we don't have video, we don't have tape recordings, but there's a lot of journal entries, as you talk about, a lot of newspaper articles from the time. You were able to read sort of firsthand accounts. We talk about unifiers and reaching across the aisle. We see it today happening bit by bit, maybe in our political system, but really not much. What did he do? Was he a magician?
Well, you know, for one thing, he had a huge advantage. Because of his role in the American Revolution, he was extraordinarily popular, not just in America, but in the world. He was probably the most popular man in the world in 1789. So that's a huge advantage. You know, that's hard to measure up to.
And Nathaniel Philbrick, as you write, in 2014, 600,000 people visited Graceland, but 1 million people visited Mount Vernon. So popularity today reigns supreme as well.
Yeah. No, Washington is one of those foundational personages. You know, he is the precedent-setting first president of this country. And, you know, he's a myth for most people. And I think that, and as is Elvis, and I think people are fascinated by myths and want to see the actual, by going to the place that person resided, you know, you're able to see the tangible evidence of the human being that inhabited, you know, that inhabited what's now this myth. And I think Washington, because of this popularity, it was his superpower. And what's extraordinary about him is that he wanted to use it not to make himself even more popular and become a potential monarch or dictator. He wanted to use that popularity to create the office of the presidency, to create a government of laws that would ultimately be more bigger than any single personality. And so that's what he was trying to do. The Anti-Federalists, who distrusted the notion of a chief executive as powerful as the U.S. president, worried that, you know, he was creating the foundation of another monarchy, you know, another George III, if you will. But that was not Washington's intent. And he, over and over again, during his tour of America, would do everything he could to prove to the people he was of them. I mentioned earlier he stayed in public taverns. I think it's hard for people today to comprehend how awful public taverns were in 1789.
No, it sounds very charming, you know. It sounds, a charming and genial innkeeper welcomes you with a scotch or a hot chocolate, and there's a nice fireplace and thick sort of feathery pillows or goose down. But was it like that?
No. These weren't the B&Bs of our imagination. These were more like, you know, the rundown motels beside the off the highway that all of us have spent a sleepless night in. In this case, fleas were a huge issue. The beds were terrible. The food even worse. It's a good thing TripAdvisor did not exist in 1789, because Washington would have been giving every place one star, if that. What made it even more interesting is, you know, all of the highfalutin people in every town and city he visited said, "Oh, don't stay at a tavern, stay with me." But his inevitable reply was, "No, I don't want to show any kind of favoritism. I am staying in public, only in public accommodations." And, you know, there were times in rural Massachusetts, for example, when innkeepers didn't quite recognize who he was, said they didn't have room for him. And so they'd have to move on at night and find another place. I mean, you know, this is not the kind of treatment of a president that we sort of assume today. Well, you know, of course, the president today travels in Air Force One, is, you know, magically appears just about everywhere he wants to go in ultimate comfort. Washington was doing something really extraordinary. While Congress was in recess, he was hitting the road, traveling at 35, 40 miles a day. He had to stop several times to feed his horses and his people, you know, with an entourage of not even a dozen people. It was not easy, and it was not always pleasant. And one of the legends, I won't call it a myth, but one of the traditions that Melissa and I kept running into, not only in New England, but in the South, was Washington, and there were various forms of this, of where Washington would say to a young person or someone who asked him, you know, would say, "I am only a man. Don't be impressed by the legend, the myth. Remember, I am only a man." And, you know, I think that was part of his point. He was saying, "Yes, I am, you know, this president, but I am one of you." You know, not that he looked like that. I mean, he's 6'4". Often he would enter a town dressed in his general's uniform upon his great white horse and creating quite a spectacle. But always he was trying to reinforce the fact that, you know, yeah, I might look good on a horse and be this extraordinary war hero, but I am also one of you.
You know, we had Chris Matthews on here recently on my show, and we have sort of a lot of political talk on here. Chris is a super knowledgeable fount of wisdom about American politics, and he and I were chatting about retail politics and some of the great retail politicians of the past few decades' ability to go into a diner and sit down and, you know, say, what's bothering you? What's going on here? What makes you happy as an American? What makes you nervous? Is this the kind of conversation George Washington was having? Of course, the tone would have been different. The syntax, all that would have been different. The accent would have been different. But did he really sit down with people or stand with people?
You know,
or did he more lecture them? Was he giving discourses?
For one thing, there was great spectacles just about everywhere he went. You know, the entrance would be on this big horse. And then there would be all of these written addresses presented to him by various groups within each community. The Sons of the Cincinnati, who were war veterans, along with the ministers in a community, you know, those kinds of civic groups. And he would get those and then respond to every one of those. But we do have accounts, for example, in Salisbury, North Carolina, still not a huge place, a town. There's a tradition of him speaking on the steps of his tavern and talking to the people and saying how, you know, he enjoys their company and their humble welcome much more than he did the ostentatious revelries of Charleston, you know, which was exactly, of course, what the people wanted to hear. But I think that it was an honest statement. Washington was, by the end of this tour, was getting very sick and tired of the pomp and circumstances of many of his welcomes, and really enjoyed his time in the countryside. And we also have in his diary where he talks about in the western part of North Carolina. And his southern tour was later than his New England tour. And by that time, the policies of administration had come into sharper focus. His Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, had come up with a very controversial tax on whiskey that was particularly unpopular in the South. And so Washington was warned before he departed on a southern tour that there would be a lot of naysayers out in the South, particularly in the inland western portions of Georgia and the Carolinas. And Washington would record in his diary that whenever someone stated their objections to the tax on whiskey, he would try to explain to them why it was necessary. Remember, this is a country that had launched into a revolution over the issue of taxation. Americans did not like being taxed, but you had to fund this strong national government created by the Constitution. And so this tax on whiskey was an important part of that. And Washington would explain the reasoning behind it. And he claimed in his diary that whenever he did that, the people would understand the necessity of the tax. Washington, by explaining his government's policies, there really seems to have changed some minds. Was he whistling in the dark? Remember, in a few years' time, Western Pennsylvania, a place he did not visit during his tour of the country, by the way, there would be the whiskey revolt over this very law. But in the South, there would be unrest over it, but ultimately the people would be more or less resigned to it. And so, you know, Washington was listening and also trying to convince people during this tour. And you mentioned Chris Matthews. He has a house here on Nantucket. I've gotten to know him a little bit. And, you know, there is no one who knows politics as a certain kind of brand of politics as well as Chris. And, you know, his time with Tip O'Neill used to say that all politics is local. And it was in the research of this book in which I identified as many of the libraries and historical societies of each town Washington visited and asked them what records they had of Washington's visit. And they sent me all sorts of things from diary entries to local history accounts to letters and newspaper clippings and things of this nature. And after working on this book, I began to realize all history is local in a very real way. You know, here we were following our president's travels, but some of the most interesting things about his travels came from local sources, from the people who saw him from the side of the road.
You know, when you talk about this larger-than-life person, in so many ways, traveling around different regions of this country, talking to people, to our modern eye, that seems sort of like expected of a politician, especially running for office. You get on your bus and you go and you say, oh, I went to all 200 counties in whatever, Iowa or whatever state, and I went to the county fair and all of that. But back then, 1789, it's pretty bizarre, right? Pretty groundbreaking that a leader would do something like that. I think maybe listeners, certainly I was not immediately struck, but then when I sat down and really thought about it, it's quite odd. I mean, you don't have a king going around saying, tell me your problems.
Right, exactly. You have, you know, the British monarch would travel in this behemoth of a gold carriage and go on what they called a royal progress, where they'd take hundreds of people from the royal court and descend upon a nobleman's house and take it over for a day or two and then move on. I mean, that's exactly what Washington was trying not to do. And, you know, and it would be extraordinary even in terms of America's future. Washington did this, but John Adams was a very different kind of man, did not enjoy public displays of any kind. And, you know, he stayed pretty close to, if he wasn't at the presidential residence. He was back home in Massachusetts. He was not someone who wanted to go out there and hobnob with the people. Thomas Jefferson, kind of similar, as was Madison. It wouldn't be until James Monroe, on the other side of the War of 1812, before another president would embark on anything resembling Washington's tour of America. And so, that's almost 30 years later. And so Washington set a precedent that was extraordinary, not only in terms of the world in 1789, but for America for the next few decades. And yet, I think if you look at, just as you were talking about, modern day campaigns, they hit the trail. And if you go into, if you attend a political rally today, there's the throbbing music, there's the flashy things happening on giant screens. It's a spectacle similar to professional sports. But Washington, in his own way, was creating the wow factor by getting on that big white horse and dressing in his general's uniform. He was doing just that kind of thing, saying, I'm president, I'm one of you, but this is something special. And so, it's a fine line between the wow factor and the humble factor. And Washington was constantly working both sides of it as he tried to make the American people understand that there was now a federal government that was out there to help them rather than to subdue them.
Broaden out for a moment, if you could talk about why you think it's important, because obviously you do, because you just wrote a book about it. Why is it important to not cancel or delete or erase or whitewash figures that may be problematic? It's another theme that comes up a lot on this show. We were talking with Dennis Washburn about his great translation of The Tale of Genji. How does he teach medieval Japanese rape scenes to undergraduates at an Ivy League school? Well, he does it somehow. Mm-hmm. It's disturbing, but there's a lot of disturbing things in art. There's a lot of disturbing things in music, paintings that make life richer at the same time as maybe making us lose a little sleep. Why is the disturbing aspect worth looking at, worth accepting along with the good?
Oh, it's we have to remain open and empathetic when examining the past, when examining each other, or we risk siloing ourselves into a self-reflective reinforcement of our preconceptions and unable to communicate effectively with others. You've got to look out. You've got to have your antennae out there, and you can't just shut down what you perceive as evil. You have to learn about it. Otherwise, you're going to be helpless when it comes to dealing with the real world, which is full of all sorts of characters. In Travels with George, I quote from Melville's Moby Dick, when Ishmael says in the first chapter that, for his journey, he wanted to be as social with evil as well as a good, because it's best to know of all the residents of wherever you're staying, that being the world. And this is the attitude I took with George Washington. And that's why I think everybody, you might love him or hate him, he was absolutely essential to the creation of the United States of America. And love it or hate it, the United States of America is the country in which we live today. And to understand it today, we need to look at it with as clear eyes as we can to the past. I think the worst thing you can do, the worst disservice you can do to someone from the past, is to try to whitewash them of their foibles and their sins. To insist that George Washington was a hero, goddammit, and how dare you say anything negative about Washington. That is to rob him of his humanity, to rob him of the incredible achievement of what he achieved, given the context of where he came from. A man who, you know, was a slave owner by at age 11, you know, to begin to doubt what you grew up with is an extraordinary thing to do. And I think that's what we all have to have, that ability, if we're going to recognize what's out there and make our own judgments based not on our own prejudices or preconceptions, but on what is actually happening out there. And so, you know, I think Washington exemplifies that. Yes, he wasn't perfect, but that doesn't mean he wasn't essential to creating the United States of America.
As you know, we always talk about music on this program, Nathaniel Philbrick, and of course, there was a lot of great music around when he was on this listening tour. You know, he didn't have a cell phone and an iPod with him, maybe, but I wonder, did he ever run into music? There probably wasn't much organized music in America at the time, but I imagine there were lots of musicians floating around, maybe playing house concerts or something like that. What was music to George Washington? Did he write about it ever? Did he like it or care?
Yeah, well, you know, there's all sorts of instances in which music had an important role in his tour. Well, for one thing, Washington loved to dance. And, you know, and if you love to dance, you got to love music. I mean, there are accounts of him during the Revolution when there would be, you know, a party in the officers' quarters, of him dancing literally all night with assorted women. I mean, he just loved it. He was an athlete. He loved that kind of movement, that rhythmic movement. You know, he was a great horseman. There's a rhythm to that as well. But, you know, so I think music was important to him. And he loved the theater too, always music associated with that. But, you know, many of the events on his tour, music played a huge part. When he went to Trenton, the women of Trenton were singing a song in his honor as he arrived and rode his horse through this grand arch, and they threw rose petals on the road before him. And, you know, these young women singing to him were, you know, it was quite a spectacle. When he entered New York by water, there were schooners that would sail past the rowboat that was taking him to the waterfront with people singing to him. And so, I mean, you know, there was all sorts of things happening. It was a part of his home that he had a piano or a version of a piano at the presidential residence. And his stepdaughter or granddaughter, Nellie, was taking lessons. And Martha, his wife, would insist that she practice for hours at a time. Nellie did not enjoy that, but it was, you know, a part of the Washington household. So I think there would be a surprising amount of music going on in the Washington household, in that whole world of a president on a national tour in the late 18th century.
And in fact, you yourself are probably passionate about music. Tell us why.
Well, I grew up in the 60s, and I was a huge Bob Dylan, Neil Young fan. I played the guitar, was in a band very briefly in my early high school years. And I've always loved music. And growing up with my kids, I was determined that I would not just luxuriate in the music of my era, but I wanted to know what was happening, you know, what was coming up. And so I got into the Replacements and all sorts of music. And then, as you know, I'm schooling my kids in the hippest music. Our son Ethan, who is now a cellist like you, developed this absolute infatuation with classical music. And so that became a big part of our household. And, you know, when we'd go driving, I'd want to listen to a college station. And Ethan, at age 11, would insist we listen to the classical station and a battle that would rage throughout his adolescence, and still, by the way, rages today. But no, it's music has been a big part of you know, my, you know, what I love And I love to go to live music, go to concerts and things like that. And because our son is a performer, been to a lot of events in which he plays, and he's now does classical, but also does all kinds of music with his cello. So it's a big part of our life here on Nantucket.
Are you listening to music right now? Anything good? Anything hip I should know about that I don't?
Well, you know, I'm beginning to run out of steam on being hip. I don't know. I think once I turn 65 and Social Security entered in, maybe I'm becoming the thing I didn't want to become. But no, I'm really into Jason Isbell. I've been a Drive-By Truckers fan forever, and he was part of that band, and now has a brilliant solo career. In our XM radio, I'm between Little Steven's Underground Garage and Outlaw Country are my go-to stations. But when I'm traveling with my 92-year-old father, I will go to the classical station and if Ethan's around, I don't know, we'll fight over it.
Well, on the XM dial, I spent a lot of time on 73, which is the 40s station. I'm huge on, mm-hmm. people who listen to this program know, huge on big band music from the 40s and all the Tommy Dorsey and Glenn Miller and all the rest. That's a great place to spend some time. I spend a lot more time there than on the classical station. You know, opening of the book features a description. People are going to think, maybe unless I know, until you start describing why I am asking about this, about the teeth of George Washington, Washington's dentures. And can you talk to us a bit about this and why it isn't so silly after all, if you look at this in depth?
Yeah, well, you know, Washington's tooth problems were never ending. Here he is, he's president of the United States and a very reluctant president of the United States. And he has one or two teeth left in his head. And by the end of his first term, he has no teeth left in his head. And he is, and he has this set of dentures that contain, the myth, of course, is that they're made of wood. They weren't made of wood. They were tended to be discolored, so they sort of may have looked like, fine mahogany or whatever. But they were made of mostly animal teeth, but some human teeth. There's some evidence that may have included the teeth of some of enslaved workers, which is, you'll have to read the book to get in, the details of that. But horse's teeth, some hippo ivory inserted in jaws of made out of tin. They were connected by a spring that applied pressure so that they wouldn't fall out of his mouth. I look to the Washington's dentures. That's why in so many of his portraits, he has this look of, like he's gritting his teeth. Well, he had to forcibly grit his teeth if he was going to keep his mouth closed with those dentures in them. And remember, this was not all vanity on Washington's part. You can't speak in a way that people can understand you unless you have some teeth in your head. He needed these dentures if he was going to function in any kind of public capacity. And so, I look to these dentures as kind of a metaphor of this country. All our intolerance, our sense of wickedly humor, our ingenuity, because they really are an ingenious contraption, verging on a Rube Goldberg kind of claptrap thing. I think they kind of are a metaphor for, who we are as a nation, this nation of, all of these constituent parts of, all ramshackling. This, I don't think America's ever felt like it actually works. it always seems on the edge of falling apart. And yet somehow we have one of the most stable governments in the world, if you look back 230 years, although it never feels like that. And so Washington's dentures are for me a kind of metaphor for this weird thing we call United States of America.
In fact, you're right. The dentures all are anxiety, despair, embarrassment, rage, racism, fear, laughter, horror, and hope ingeniously cobbled together into a contraption once clamped between the jaws of our first president. It's an odd thought, but if you read about all the different things the teeth were made up of, you read about how these different dentists were working to find some solution that he could sort of make his way through the day with, it's not so crazy. And it's a well, nice way to begin the book, I think.
Well, you know, I think people have such a tendency to sort of, if not dismiss Washington, you know, think of him, well, you know, yes, he had his wooden teeth. Ha, 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 ha. And then the other one is Washington slept here. You know, every house in America built before 1800, Washington slept in it. Ha, 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 ha. And I by the end of our journey across this country, retracing his steps, you begin to realize these aren't just historical tidbits or jokes. He was actually trying to do something serious here. And if he hadn't been staying in all these taverns, if he hadn't been doing all of this sleeping around, if you want to call it that, we probably wouldn't be a country today. And if he hadn't had those dentures, you know, he wouldn't have been able to go from community to community and do his best to justify this outrageous new form of government that had been created by the Constitution.
You know, I was about to ask you sort of to put a fine point on the end of all this, but you sort of half answered. I was about to ask, did he accomplish what he set out to do? Was his trip a success? And it sounds like you're saying, yes, it was.
I think it was. But there's no moment in Washington's career where he himself feels that sense of accomplishment. You know, he goes on this tour just as the partisan divide is beginning to form within his own cabinet, as Thomas Jefferson, who is his Secretary of State, begins to, even as Washington's trying to pull the country together, is secretly beginning to organize the resistance, the anti-federalists, into what will become the Republican Party, not the Republican Party we have today, but one that cast a skeptical eye on the power of the federal government. And, you know, so Washington, he finishes this tour and all heck is breaking loose. The political divide begins to widen. Hamilton and Jefferson are, you know, the equivalent of shouting at each other. You know, by the end of his first term, he doesn't want to run again. But both sides say, you've got to run again. Otherwise, you know, this growing political furor will rip the embryonic country to pieces. And so he very, very reluctantly starts a second term, only to have, you know, the congressional elections, as so often happens to a president in his second term, go to the political opposition, the Republican anti-federalists. And so it's a tough 8 years for him. He doesn't. Yes, without this tour, we wouldn't have an America. And it was a success. But Washington was never able to sort of sit on his laurels and say, you know, see what I accomplished. Give me a high five.
What are you going to write now? What's next?
Well, I am looking west. One of my books is called The Last Stand, about the Battle of Little Bighorn. And it took me 4 years. I spent a lot of time out in Montana and the West researching it. And it was one of the great experiences of my life. And I miss the West. I want to get back out there. And being on Nantucket, back in, we had the fire of 1846 that destroyed much of the town's waterfront. But soon after that, there was the discovery of gold. And Nantucket was almost evacuated of able-bodied men as they sailed the whale ships they had once used to hunt the whale around Cape Horn to the Golden Gate, abandoned them for the gold fields. And so my next book is going to be about the California Gold Rush. People went more famously overland by wagon across the country, but they also went by sea. They also went by steamship boat to Panama across the isthmus. And so that's what I'm turning my attention to now, and I'm quite excited about it.
Are you going to do this via sea? You're going to sail? You're a sailor, aren't you?
Yes, I'm a sailor. I don't know if I'm going to sail around the Horn at this point, but I know I will get out. I know I will get out in the San Francisco Bay area at some point. And already my wife and I have flew out to Kansas City and followed the California Trail all the way to Sacramento, California. It took us 2 weeks. And was, you know, there's a part of this country that coastal people, whether you're on the West Coast or the East Coast, have no clue that exists. There's another planet in the middle of our country. And this was a wonderful experience in making our way across that, following the 49ers.
Well, so long as you go out west and steer clear of the wildfire smoke and that poor air quality, just keep an eye on those monitors and flee to the northeast if you need. And meanwhile, look forward to the book on the gold rush and hope to talk about that on this show next time. Nathaniel Philbrick with this very thought-provoking and moving book, Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. Indeed, sir, I thank you.
Well, thank you, Daniel. It's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.